Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, Ruth.
We are here in your office to talk some more about your family history in medicine.
Right.
And do I have your permission to record this interview?
You do.
We better put the date on there. It's June
14th, 4:20 p.m.
June 14th, 2000,
4:20 p.m. Yeah. Right. We were sort of getting in our last interview to the discussion of the medical school and residency time. And I don't know which stories my mother has shared, so stop me. But there are at least two that I remember very well. One is that she and my dad actually were introduced when they were riding the bus together to school, and they had all had to go home and collect a 24-hour urine specimen. And she had her specimen in a jar in a paper bag, and he had his, and he offered to carry hers, which is, she indicates, is the first time they met, but that he did have his first date, or maybe two or three, with her twin before he asked her out. And the three of them were something of an item for a long time, although she had several other boyfriends in and out. The three of them often did a lot of things together, and of course that lasted a lifetime. The other issue that the other story that I never really believed, I sat my mother down and asked her to tell me, and she told me all the details recently, and I declare the story is true, and it's the story of the turkey. Do you know the story?
We've got the turkey story. Tom.
Okay, it's unbelievable. I can picture them. The part of it, people all around town talk about that turkey waking up in the bathtub and all of that sort of thing, and I always figured my mom made it up because she's about as good as me at coloring up a story. But she described them, the three of them, walking down the street carrying the darn thing like you see Europeans do when they go down to buy the lamb at the market, carrying the doggone turkey trussed up. My dad, the live turkey, trussed up, feathers and all, my dad carried him in his arms quite a few blocks, 7 or 8 blocks, to get back to their apartment because they couldn't get on the bus with a turkey, and of course they didn't have a car. So I really, when she described that to me, I really believed her and believed the whole story. Their training, there were probably, I think, 7 or 8 women in their class. MCV had a significant number. I think Hopkins had some women, Women's Medical College of Philadelphia. Of course, Women's Medical College had the most by far. There were not, I don't remember that there were other schools that had any significant number of women in the country, but those women in the class grew to know and like each other a lot and do things together. And of course, the demographics of medicine didn't change for the next 35, 40 years. Medical school was still that way when I went. If you look at the picture of my class at UNC in 1972, it was still, there were only about 5 women in the class. That didn't change very much. So a woman doctor was unusual in the 60s, too. And usually if they were there, they were either pediatricians or obstetricians. They were the two things they mostly did. A lot of women obstetricians. Anyway, my mother, I think they were all good students. They all worked very hard. And they got married. My mother and dad got married at the end of their junior year, their third year of medical school. And they came down here to Greenville to be married. And I guess that's really how they decided to come here. Their father was still the pastor at Jarvis Church, so they were married in the parsonage, in the living room of the parsonage at Jarvis Church here in Greenville. I don't know if she told you that. And of course, he was still here for many years thereafter, even, I believe, almost to the point of the end of the war when they came home. I think he may have just left Greenville about the time that they came home. Dad came home from the end of, at the end of the war, and they moved here. As they started their residency, of course, the war years, the war came along and intervened, and Dad finished just the 1 year of internship, and he was gone. And after spending some fairly brief time in the States training, he was shipped overseas, and he was not home for nearly 3 years, a very long time. And most of that time, although he was in England for some relatively small period, most of that time was in, I think, close to 2 years, and he's very reluctant to talk about it.
Yes, I noticed that.
Yeah, very. Most of what I got about it for many years came from her. He had written it home, and she could remember his letters. All of his letters to her were lost in the flood.
This last flood?
Yes.
Oh.
Unbelievable. She had a whole, we found it. We found a trunk load of his letters to her from the war as we were emptying their house. We put them in storage there at Cypress Glen. We could have gotten them out, but we didn't have a key to the storage area as we were hurrying to get everything out, and so they were completely lost, which is tragic. But he was in combat most of the time in Belgium and France, with running a field hospital, picking up casualties along the roadside as the day went along, hiding under the operating table at night as the bombs came over and so forth. That's where he told me the one thing he does love to say is that he cannot even stand the odor of a Brussels sprout, much less to eat it. Because he said he felt like he lived on Brussels sprouts for nearly 2 years. Yeah. And he'll eat cabbage, which I think stinks like hell and is not that far from a Brussels sprout, but he won't eat a Brussels sprout. During that time, the two women and a number of other women and a handful of old men did everything at the Medical College of Virginia Hospital. Surgery, everything. My mother said that the two of them were particularly valued in the operating room because of their small hands. And they could get into certain spaces that other people couldn't. So they said they spent a lot of time in the OR.
She didn't tell us that.
Yeah.
What had your daddy done his first year of internship?
General. He did a general. In those days, you did a rotating internship, and that's what he did. That's what they all did. And then they went on into pediatric residency, but that was when they completed their residency, they stayed and worked ultimately, and some of their training was deferred because of their need to do other things because of just the manpower, the workforce shortage was so great. They did a lot of deliveries. They did a lot of emergency care. They did a lot of home visits. They rode the ambulances regularly out into the tenements of Richmond and went into homes and delivered care directly there. It sounds to me from talking to them like it was a really tough existence. It was living from 6 a.m. to midnight, working all the time every day and sleeping when you could for a very long time.
She described an interesting procedure she had to do with patients. I believe she had to type. It wasn't blood typing she did. It was typing, almost culturing infections.
Yeah.
That she had to do and to determine what
typing the organism.
Specific.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, they used to have to do to determine what antibiotic would work. They used to have to actually read the cultures and themselves and to do a laborious, we have these little discs we drop onto the plate now to see if it worked, but to do a laborious set of tests to determine whether or not the patient was sensitive to the antibiotic. One of the things that she told me was that was striking during the war was that as penicillin became available, and of course it went up first overseas before it really became available to any civilian populations, but as it became available, she told me about going on to the pneumonia ward. The first morning after they used penicillin the first time, they went on to the pneumonia ward and no one was dead. And she said they virtually never came on in the morning when there wasn't somebody dead. They had to take care of the dead every day. Every morning, that was the first order of business, to go around and see who was dead. So imagine the difference of seeing that penicillin. And of course, they saved the urine from the patients to extract the penicillin that they had urinated out and to give it back to other patients.
Fascinating.
Yeah, something. And a hell of a lot safer than the sulfur that they were having to use in a lot of just about all they had to use in those days.
Tom, could you help us understand the sulfur and the penicillin?
Mm-hmm.
The sulfur came first.
Yeah, a long time before penicillin. Mm-hmm.
And that had all sorts of unwanted side effects.
Right. Sulfur, particularly in infants, sulfur drugs cause serious liver damage. In adults, they caused a number of liver and kidney problems at times, a very high incidence of allergic reactions to the sulfur drugs. They're still around. We still take them. I just took one recently, and they're still effective. But they also were ineffective against most of the more virulent so-called gram-positive organisms, or if the organisms quickly acquired resistance to the sulfur drugs. So they just weren't a lot of good in serious infections, and particularly in pneumococcal infections. There were some disastrous experiments done with sulfur drugs in infants, in which infants were given the drugs when they had congenital infections and suffered severe permanent damage as a result.
So the penicillin was very precious.
Unbelievable. And of course, nowadays we can't imagine that a drug that's available, that exists, can't be made available. And we can just about always go to the CDC and get what we need. It was a drug that was in mass manufacture, and they couldn't get any of it. All of it had to go to the military first, overseas, to deal with the wounded and so forth. So I imagine that it was a very different environment. You understood that people did understand that the resources of the system were limited, and they had to do with what they could get. And we no longer feel any of those constraints. You expect to be able to get whatever you need. And of course, we're out of control for that and many other reasons. But I can imagine that it was, and it certainly, I think, impacted on their practice and the way they thought about allocation of resources. And they couldn't imagine doing an unnecessary test. Why would you do that? It would be such a waste of money and resources. We don't have money and resources. And now you do an unnecessary test because a patient wants you to.
Your mom and dad, now, before he went off to the war, and before they finished medical school, I'm not quite sure what the chronology was, but I understand they worked at a home for incurables.
That's right. Oh, I should bring you, I have it in my car, the letter, whatever that was, the home for incurables. I got a commendation letter which commended my father on his work in the home for the incurables, and was written to someone else as a letter of recommendation for him. And it's in my car. I'll walk down with you and we'll get it. I found it in their things when we were cleaning up after the flood. There were a few things there that caught my eye. And this one had penciled in, "Show this to our boys someday." on the cover, and they'd long since forgotten it. So I grabbed it and showed it to the boys. Yeah. And I've left it kind of sitting in my car. When people get in it, they say, "What's that?" And it's got a 1938 date on it or whatever. And I say, "Well, read it." And
it's just document.
Yeah.
So they did that, and they did other things to sort of put themselves through.
That's how they made it. They didn't have any money. They couldn't pay for their education. They had they actually had debt when they went into practice. Enough debt that they really couldn't afford to live in a very nice house, even a moderately nice house. We lived in a house that probably mostly poor families would have lived in. It was nice. It was quite comfortable, but it certainly wasn't well appointed. My dad had to go down every night and stoke the furnace, or bank up the furnace before we went to bed, so the heat would go off. And in the morning, he had to go down and stoke it up, and all of that was a part of our daily routine.
In spite of that surgery experience that your mom had while your dad was away, he said that the way they worked it out was he did most of the stitching.
Right.
And your mother, she said that worked out just fine.
Yeah. She did the patient, the counseling and those sorts of things, and the more direct patient service while he did the suture. He likes to suture. He's good at it. When they started practicing Greenville, you remember, of course, that they were together in a rented space downtown. And she came here in January of 46. I'm sorry, I believe, in fact, she came in December of 45, maybe, and he came home somewhere around February or March of 46, because I was born in December, so... it was not that event. That train started rolling, I think, about the same day he got home. And they were up above Mr. Key Brown's drugstore, which became Beddingfield's, which became Cubby's downtown, and it's still right there on
the
corner.
Thank you for telling me which building that is.
Now you know. It's right above the old Cubby's. And you used to come, if you walked down around to the back of the store on 5th, there was a swinging door, and you'd go up the stairs. You remember the old offices up there. And there still are. There are apartments up there now. I don't know how they're accessed, but there were swinging doors, and you went up the stairs, and they had an office there. She didn't have anything to do. He had all the patients, so she would help him in his practice. For about the first year, that's what they did. But he had to do several different things to make a living. They looked for a whole bunch of different sources of income, and they never were able to accumulate any significant wealth. I was talking to them when I was in college, and their equity situation was well under $100,000. Including their home, and so they worked extremely hard their whole lives and never were really able to accumulate anything
to allow them a relaxed lifestyle.
Right, exactly. I think it was incredibly fortunate that they both had ties to the state. That she actually started with the university when he was at the infirmary. She started helping out some as the demand grew, part-time, and particularly with women and gynecological issues and such, and sensitive issues. I remember there was a big panty raid sometime back in the 50s, and she went over there and examined all the girls, so he didn't have to do it. You can picture the scene. Boy, it was a snowstorm, and boys were stuffing snow down the girls' pants, and they put up quite a scene, and they caused, of course, nobody got charged. It was in the 50s. Late 50s. But she began to work over there some, so they both had ties, and they both felt very closely tied to the college. So when he had accumulated a lot of time in that part-time at the infirmary. So when he went full-time and then she went to the DEC, they were actually able to get into the state retirement plan, which was an enormous blessing because it has given them a fixed monthly income that is adequate to meet their needs. So that's where they get everything. That's all they have other than what they've inherited from other members of his family and her twin sister. Going back to the drugstore, apparently her practice grew fast. They decided to move the practice down to the Person House, the house that was across from the Flanagan House, which is the art museum, and to live upstairs and to practice together there, and that was really a problem because her practice grew fast and it created this sort of scene of hordes of little children running around, and he was looking after a lot of elderly folks, and it created problems. So he joined Brooks and several others in the medical arts clinic, and they built that clinic over there. And I think 52 or 53, they built that clinic over in on 4th Street, and he moved there.
And at that time, was the hospital still functioning, the one on Johnston and 4th?
Well, it was. It would have been in transition because wasn't it 53 that this hospital opened? I think it was. So about that time. So they really were not. Probably was about that time, about the time they were moving in, that the hospital was moving out here. And of course the medical community was growing, but we did not have an obstetrician. There was Dr. Ann Heisinger, who was doing some gynecology, but I don't think ever did obstetrics. And she was I think she had come out of the mission field and had come here, a single woman, maybe 10, 15 years older than my mother. There was a Dr. Pott, who had been in the mission field in China and who had come here. He was elderly but was doing some OB. He did deliver us. But my dad was doing a huge amount of OB.
Do you remember a physician named Har?
I sure do. Oh, real well.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell me about him?
Well, Fred Har is older than my mother by 4 or 5 years. I think they came here at about the same time. He was a general practitioner. He had not had a pediatric residency. Neither my mother nor her twin ever took their boards in pediatrics, even though they completed their residency. And it had to do with the war. They got sidetracked by the war, and years went by, and when it was over, they said, well, we just won't bother.
No point.
Yeah, it wasn't important then, which is kind of sad for them. But he was a general practitioner who did nothing but pediatrics. He was deeply loved in the community. He never practiced anyway but by himself. He had an office in the old Guaranty Bank building, which became later the State Bank building, and is gone. And it was on Five Points downtown. It was a triangular building like the Flatiron Building in New York.
Oh.
And it had, and the bank was in the main part of the downstairs floor, and there was a large barbershop called a Sanitary Barbershop that was there. It was on Dickinson. As you came up Dickinson to, it doesn't even work anymore. That whole part is gone. But Dickinson continued and hit 5th and Evans. And it was in the gap between Dickinson and 5th. So on its backside, it was across from what is the Percolator now and what was then the State Theater. And on the front side, you had the barbershop. And his office was up in that building. There were a couple of dentists and Dr. Har. And he was in that building until the building went away. And then he bought the old office of Dr. Hoot, who was an otolaryngologist here, who died in the 60s and who stopped doing surgery probably before 1960. I think actually had his surgical privileges revoked. sometime late in the 50s. Dr. Haar was as popular a pediatrician as you'll ever see. He had a huge following of patients. He and my mother were always very affectionate and civilized towards each other, and probably agreed on nothing other than the beauty of his roses. She had some very strong views about Dr. Haar and believed that he was using what she described as homeopathic doses of medication, and was concerned that in the care, particularly of asthmatics, that there was some serious unnecessary risk being taken, and in the, I'm being very careful here, you understand, in the behavioral norms of the day, you didn't deal with those, that you couldn't, I guess, deal with those issues very directly. She confronted him about some issues, they disagreed, and they never shared a night of night call for their whole lives. That was the end of it. And yet they were always quite cordial and civilized towards each other, but she wouldn't share a call with him. I'll tell you what Dr. Haar was wonderful at. So was she. He was there for you, and he was always there for you. He'd sit up all night with your child. He was sitting right there holding your hand. He was there being reassuring. And you know, most pediatric patients, no matter what they have, get well no matter what you do. 75% of the time, probably, they just get well no matter what you do. And he had a real large following. He practiced well into his 80s and way well beyond the time when he should have continued to practice. People of conscience and character like Earl Trevathan went to him and asked him to please stop, and he just wouldn't. And ultimately he did lose his hospital privileges. He's got children. I'm very sensitive to how his children might feel about anything I might say. I used to take care of his grandchildren in Raleigh. One of his sons died just 3 or 4 years ago. He was a pharmacist, died young of cancer. The other is an accountant in Raleigh. You'll find, if you talk to lay people, you'll find a lot of people who, he's legendary. They loved him. And I think he was different from my mother. He was not as direct and sometimes blunt, and he wasn't going to get into an argument with you about your child. She was. She
could stand her ground.
Yeah, she made more than one person angry. Somebody come in wanting this, and she would say, no, I'm not going to do that. That's not what you need. But God knows she also has a following of people who just...
I understand that she even took patients into your home.
Almost unbelievable. I don't know how many times you've heard this, but I have a friend, his name is Ralph Sullivan. Do we need to just turn it over? Okay. I have a friend whose name is Ralph Sullivan, and who's goes in his family by Butch. His father was Ralph Sullivan Sr. He was in the oil business here in Greenville. I still see Ralph. He lives in Garner, married a local girl, and they live in Garner, and I still see him periodically, and he still gets teary talking about this particular memory, which I share, and I can still see him. I was a tiny fella, because he's 2 or 3 years older than me. The Sullivans had a daughter, and she had, I suspect, some form of spina bifida or meningomyelocele. And of course there was no treatment. And she was dying. And now she's not the only patient we took into our home, but this was unique in that it was a bad, bad winter. It must have been 49 or so, 50.
Yeah.
It was a bad, bad winter, very cold. It was very difficult for people to get around. Getting to the hospital was very, very difficult. And for my mother to get back and forth was hard. And it had snowed. And so she said, we'll just take the baby into our house. And she set up a room. Now, we were living upstairs. But she set up a room downstairs and put the baby in the room and let the relatives come in and sit with the baby 24 hours a day and just kept the baby there. It was Christmas time. Apparently, the baby stayed there more than a week. What Ralph remembers so vividly is that we ran out of coal. The whole town was low, and we ran out of coal for that house, which was the old person house on Evans. And his father went and talked to the coal and ice man, which is, that place is right down here on the corner of Albemarle Avenue and Fifth Street right now. You can still see it. And they allowed them to go like Ruth in the fields and glean, pick up the coal off the ground. And he and his daddy went out there and picked two bags of coal up off the ground and carried it over to my mother's office for her to get, so our house could be warm, so the baby would be warm. And Ralph remembers his daddy walking up the steps with his daddy holding his hand, with his big coat on and his hat on, going in to see his little baby sister who died there in our house. But we had, God knows, I can't even tell you how many times I've walked into the living room and my mama's been in there with somebody who smells bad and got a little baby with them and three or four people hanging out on the porch kind of looking in. And it was not at all uncommon for us to come home from church and a car load of people being sitting out front waiting for my mama to come home so they could bring the baby in for her to look at. And most of them poor folks. And by the way, there was no racial difference. They were probably more white, because most of the black folks didn't have a vehicle to get there with. They'd just be there. And I can remember this one family, and despite the fact that I can't imagine any of them ever reading the history that might be written, I won't say their name, but I can see my father now. We'd be driving home. This is when, after we've moved out to Rock Spring Road, so it had to be after 1950, 60, and we drive up, and there they are again. Whole carload of them, all the windows down, little children sticking all out the windows and everything, and my mother says, "Oh, Fred, Lord, Fred, they're the so-and-sos." And Daddy just whipped right, turned the corner and went right around the block. And we went off somewhere to get lunch. The little daughter of that particular family who never paid a nickel, not a nickel. And they weren't the kind of good old hard-working poor folks who show up on your steps with a ham. You know, they just came and got the service and didn't pay. That was that. Plenty of folks still around like that. But the little girl was in our little den, and my mother was looking in her ears, and lucky the dog was in the house, and the little child looked like she was going to molest Lucky, and about 2 years old, you know. And my mother said, "Now, honey, Lucky's ears hurt bad, honey. If you touch Lucky's ears, she might bite you." And she went over there and grabbed Lucky's ear and pulled it, and Lucky bit her.
Oh, dear.
And they said they were going to sue us. Can you picture the whole scene? Of course, it didn't amount to anything. There are a few other things about my mother that ought to be told, and my father did plenty of this too, but one is that she kept an account at Hollowell's drugstore. Anybody in Greenville can tell you about it, or any doctor in Greenville. And it was her charge account, and she put her patient's medicines on it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And if people couldn't pay, she just called Mr. Hollowell and Mr. Johnson. They were the two people, and she said, just put it on my account. And that was that. And there was never any discussion, and the patient was never given any. The patient never knew where it came from. They just knew they went to the drugstore and got it.
And such generosity.
Yeah, yeah, and God knows how many thousands
of
dollars.
It had two locations.
Yeah, it originally, the location where she began to do that, and they had the two locations very close to each other for a while, but it was on Dickinson. And it was in the place where I think not glass, what's it called? There's a glass company in there now, but it was on Dickinson across almost directly across Dickinson from 9th, where 9th hits Dickinson. Yeah, Ernest and Knott was what it was, E&K or something like that. It was right next door. It was on the corner right there. Had a big, long soda fountain. There was Hollowell's, Biggs, Beddingfields, and Warren's. They were the drugstores in town. Biggs, Beddingfields, and Warren's were all downtown. Biggs was by the courthouse. Warren's was up the street a block. And Beddingfields was in the old Cubbies. And then Hollowell's was out there on Dickinson. Those were the stores. And they all, of course, now Hollowell's was where she kept her account for free medicine. I think she always did that. But she had a good relationship with all of them. And Beddingfield and Biggs did a lot of her prescriptions, probably less so. Warren's, and I couldn't tell you why. It's just the way who the patients wanted. I hung out in all those drug stores. And a lot of times I'd get a free soda out of them. Yeah, they'd give them to me. And I did, one of the things I did with Biggs, at Biggs that my friends still love to talk about is I started charging things in there. I found out that my mama had a charge account in there, and I just started saying charge it to Dr. Moline, and I was going in there and buying comic books, and the little clerk was taking care of it, and Mr. Biggs called my mama. And I got caught. It sure was fun while it lasted, though.
What did she do when she found out? What was her response?
Oh, I can remember only a handful of serious times when my mother expressed serious anger at us. Very, very rarely. She wasn't angry at all. She sat me down and explained what I'd done. I think she was probably laughing like hell back in the lab room with her friends, the nurses who were all her pals. But she, of course, made me go up and explain to Mr. Biggs, and then I had to go and work to earn back some of the money, which at 10 cents an hour comes mighty slow.
Now, who did you work for?
Her.
Like
mowing grass or doing whatever. I was able to negotiate her up to a quarter an hour by the time I was 10 or 11 years old, but for a long time it was a dime. It was some rough work for a dime. She was unique about catching you in something and using a really skillful ploy to teach you something out of it. And as you remember, my grandmother lived in our house, and she, much of the year, my grandmother irons, and she was a very severe woman, and when we came home, if she'd caught us in an error, she was very likely to call my dad when he got home, bring him in and tell him he needed to punish us and that we'd been very bad and we'd been willfully disobedient, and then he'd have to spank us. It was just awful. But my mother would always, she always had a little ploy. She caught me stealing. And William Allen, Charles Finch, and I were stealing from the Rose's dime store downtown. Woolworth's downtown, not Rose's. Nope, Rose's. It was Rose's, McClellan's, and Woolworth, I think. But we were stealing, and she caught us. because Charles stayed home from school for 2 days with an asthma attack because he was actually, I think it was just his anxiety over having.
Sure.
And so he spilled the beans. So we all got caught, and of course she just didn't say a word except that I had to go back down to the store myself by myself at age 8 and walk in there with that Duncan yo-yo I'd stolen and return it. And that was one of the worst days of my life. I walked up and down the aisle of that store. I bet I wore a hole in it. Scared to death to go up to anybody, and knowing they already knew, surely, that I was a thief. But the fact is that of course, she properly prepared them. When I finally handed the woman the yo-yo and tried to mumble something, she was already prepared quickly with a reply. My mother had already called them and told them I'd stolen it. She caught me and my friend Bill Proctor with a condom. Bill identified what one was for me, helped me learn that thing. We were 9 years old, 8, 9 years old, not a bit older than that, riding our bicycles. He told me you could get them in the bus station for a quarter.
Dollar, hour's wages.
That's right. That's exactly right. So we went to the bus station with a quarter. By then I was probably getting a quarter. And we went to the bus station with a quarter and bought one. And then we put them, in fact, we got two for a quarter, I believe. And Bill told me some god-awful, bawdy limericks and rhymes, which I learned about Piss-Pot Pete or some sort of thing like that, you know. And then we went home, thought it would be funny to inflate them and to walk through my mother's office and walk into the waiting room, and we proceeded to do so. My mother, she still loves to talk about Miss Cobb being in there and saying, "Malene, your boy's out here with a condom. Tommy's got a condom out here." And which I don't know what they call it then, probably a rubber. But anyway, this is what my mother did with that. Bill and I had to come back down there. First we got real embarrassed. Then we had to come back down there at 2:00. We had an appointment. And she's standing there in room number 2 with a baby girl on the table, diaperless. And the first thing she does is demonstrate exactly what female anatomy looks like to us. Now, that's the first thing she did. Here it is, boys. Now, and here we're going, oh, could we get under the... Now, see, this is the vagina. You can picture all of this. And we're dying. We're dying of humiliation. Then she gets a book and sits us up on the table beside her. And Bill is just excited. She's going through the book, and I think, it's my mother telling me this stuff. She taught us everything there was to know right then and there on the spot. Are there any questions, boys? No, ma'am. No, Dr. Malene. And we were up and gone.
Yeah. Well, she wanted to make sure you got it.
That's right.
Right source, right. The proper authority. I understand that she taught, she said... They call it something else, but she said, what I did was teach sex ed.
That's
in
right.
The schools.
In the schools. And my dad often taught the boys, and she taught the girls, and they were
Your
on.
Dad was in on
mm-hmm,
it as well.
That's correct. And when I was in the 6th grade, he was instructing my class. Johnny Collins raised his hand and asked, well, how exactly do you get pregnant? Is it done with a machine? He already knew, of course. But my dad then proceeded to give all the details. But right there in front of me in the class, my mother was across the hall. She did it for years, probably more than he did. But often they shared the responsibility because they split up boys and girls in. Yeah, she was good on sex ed. Bill reminded me of something. I still know Bill. He's a pal of mine still, and we have lunch at B's once a month or so. Bill is one of those people who really loved my mother and my father. They both took care of him over time. He loved them both very much and still does. But Bill told me about my mother coming for house calls. He said, you know, Tom, in case you don't know it, your mother was a terrible driver. Well, let me just tell you, I know it. I know it. She drove lead-footed, ignoring... she was a pretty skillful driver, but she was on a mission all the time and never took the time to be careful about things. So it was very common for her to drive. When she parked in front of Bill's house, she always drove up on the curb. And it's one of the things that he remembers. Mama, Dr. Moline's up on the curb again. One time his mother told me she had a stroke and was back here in town, and she told me before she died that she remembered Bill saying, "Mama, I think you need to drive Dr. Moline home," because she's driven up on the curb again.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Precious. So many memories.
Yeah, the house calls were a unique aspect because you sat in the car and waited and waited and waited in one house to the next to the next to the next. And I still remember what people had. I remember when Jimmy Moy had nephritis and so forth, and I remember stopping and waiting and sitting outside. Most of the houses I couldn't go in because of the contagion. Although I remember that once I'd had measles, I was allowed into the house with the child with measles and so forth. And,
you said early on you assisted your mother.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember telling you about doing the spinal taps. She would have me hold quite often. She had two or three patients who had bad chronic problems. I remember one hydrocephalic little girl. I remember one child with sickle cell disease who had to come into the office and stay for prolonged periods.